It's time now for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Yesterday, Congresswoman Jackie Speier from California introduced a bill that would require members of the House of Representatives to take sexual harassment training. It's something the Senate already does, not the House.
And on Monday, the Senate passed an extension of the long-term unemployment benefits that expired at the end of last year. Their revival has been contentious on Capitol Hill, sometimes seeming likely, other times not so much. And now it's up to the House to decide its fate.
And Democrats raised more money than Republicans last month in the Senate midterm election race. Paul Singer joins us now to talk about all these issues. He's with us every week at this time to look at the inner workings of Congress. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. I'm busy changing my passwords at the moment.
Yeah. Hurry up and do that or not. I'm still not quite sure. So as I mentioned, Congresswoman Speier proposed this requirement that everyone in the House would have to take sexual harassment training.
I think it's unnecessary. They seem to be perfectly well trained in how to sexually harass people.
Ouch. Oh.
You know, this is all a fallout from this Congressman, Vance McAllister, who is a freshman from Louisiana, who was caught on a surveillance tape making out with one of his staffers, which is not bad unless, of course, in this case, the congressman happens to be married, as well as having run his campaign on a very sort of Christian conservative platform. So it's bad for him, and it just looks bad for the Congress. And they do this every couple of years. Somebody on Capitol Hill starts, you know, dating a staffer, cheating on their spouse, grabbing people they shouldn't be grabbing. And we go through this whole process of a conversation about, oh, we should have sexual harassment training. Like, no, you should be better human beings.
Well, the Senate has been doing this training, not the House. Do you know why the Senate got it, the House didn't?
Well, I mean, first of all, the Senate is smaller and it's easier to do, kind of one-on-one training with folks. The other thing is that even in the Senate, it's kind of ad hoc. I mean, both chambers have, sort of training, particularly for new members. They get through a whole bunch of management training, how to set up an office. And keep in mind that each of these congressional offices operates like a separate business, a separate small business. It's particularly true in the House. So what trainings they get and how they implement them and what their sort of policies are, workplace policies are really dependent on each congressional office. There is no sort of overseer of the entire body.
This isn't a new issue, right? I mean, this is something that I would suspect has gone on for centuries and maybe is only now being viewed as a big problem?
I'm not even sure that's true. I mean, without slandering anybody improperly, I believe it was a Senator Bob Packwood who 25 years ago was, forced out because of, improper relations with women. There have been members of Congress for years who've been forced out or forced to step down. I mean, keep in mind, in most of these cases, you're not talking about violations of law. What you're talking about is violations of sort of human rights and human interactions, and it's a public humiliation. People don't like being represented in Congress by folks who do this stuff.
This is a Democrat bringing this up after a scandal involving a Republican. Is the partisan issue there significant?
Not really. I mean, I think obviously the Democrats are going to make hay out of this one. But next week it'll be a Democrat. Don't worry about it.
And a lot of the reporting on this has mentioned the former congressman, Democratic congressman, and now former mayor of San Diego, who had massive sexual harassment problems of his own.
Right. And, don't forget Anthony Weiner, one of our favorites, who was sending sexually inappropriate tweets to people. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of ways to do this wrong, and Congress frequently finds those ways.
So is this a law that would have to pass, or is this something that House leadership could just say, hey, this is the new rule?
If it's a law that's going to pass, it's not going to happen. So then you can get to – I mean, the Congress can pass its own rules, but even that, keep in mind that when Congress passes new rules, they pass them as if they're laws. At the beginning of every session, they have to vote on them. So – you know, it really, again, it comes down to public humiliation. And I think, my suspicion is, and this is strictly suspicion, I have not reported on this much, that, like, this guy McAllister is probably going to get a lot of pressure now from Republican leaders to just go away. Again, it's not a formal rule. It's just they don't want this around.
Well, turning to legislation in Congress, we saw the Senate passing benefits for the long-term unemployed back and forth on this for a long time now. Right. Now it goes to the House. The president is saying, hey, House, pass this thing. What's going to happen there, do you think?
Well, they're pretty uninterested in passing it in the House for a couple of reasons. You know, one thing to keep in mind, now these benefits have been lapsed since December, and the short-term reinstatement would be a five-month reinstatement through basically the end of May. But, of course, we're getting up close to the end of May, so by the time they pass this bill, they're going to have to extend it again. And the House Republicans, their primary concern is that this is not paid for in any way. There's no offsets. There's no other provision in here to sort of create jobs. They're looking for, is there a way to do some sort of a tax credit or something else that would be a job creation portion or offsetting the cost of this benefit rather than simply being, you know, I think it's what, $10 billion worth of just direct aid. I don't see a great deal of enthusiasm for bringing this up in the House.
And that line of argument is pretty much the same as it was months ago, right? Democrats say this is an economic necessity. People are out of work. Republicans say, lovely, but we need to pay for it, and let's work in the job creation element.
Correct. Yeah, you will hear this over and over again. And again, even if the debate doesn't change, Democrats think this argument works in their favor because it makes them look like they're the ones who are helping the working man, and Republicans are opposing. So even if the House Republicans don't take it up, the Democrats will pass it again, just to make the point.
And is that a point then that they'll wave around in election ads and that sort of thing?
Sure is.
Do you think there's that much at stake for Republicans for not passing it, though? They can just say, hey, this is consistent with our views on spending and job creation.
Right. And I think they've made that bet at this point that stuff like this, it's a short-term aid package. It's not a long-term reform. It's not a major social program. This is the kind of thing where they feel like they can safely say, we are taking the conservative smart government stand against the sort of just give away a lot of money stand. And that's sort of the way they will position it. And I think they feel like they are on relatively solid ground there.
So there's a good shot that this will be one of the many things that the Senate and House disagree on, so nothing happens.
That is right. I know. I'm becoming repetitive on your show, but yeah, that's correct.
reality is being repetitive, I think.
Yes, you're just reporting it, man.
So speaking of those elections, we saw new reports on fundraising, mainly for the race for Senate. The midterm election's going on. Control of the Senate is at stake. Democrats control it right now. Republicans seem increasingly confident, as we've mentioned before, that they can take control. What did we see in the money race there?
Well, you know, all of these reports come out in the next week or so, the sort of quarterly reports for the big political campaigns. And I would warn you to look at all of them a little skeptically, because everyone's going to come out and say, ooh, we got the more money this quarter, and we got the less money last quarter, and we got more. And everyone finds a way to spin this. You know, one side will say, well, we got more money, but yeah, they've got more debt. Oh, yeah, we have more cash on hand. It's all very incremental.
So they're all waving around balance sheets at us.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think, you know, what the real issue for your listeners to keep in mind is that every year more and more and more money flows into this process, into the political process. And the committees, the party committees, are now sort of the shrinking portion of that money. Where the real money is going to start to show up is in these third-party groups, the 501c4, the super PACs, the political, non-political social welfare organizations. I mean, this is where you'll see enormous sums of money spent in particularly competitive races. And so when some of these various committees report, you know, a dollar amount for the quarter, sure, they'll put out a press release saying we did well, but that money is not going to matter much. So what's really going to matter is the big outside money come, you know, September and October.
Well, the Supreme Court's Citizens United opinion a few years back opened the door to a lot of the money you were just talking about. How about this new one, the McCutcheon decision from the Supreme Court? Is that going to let more money flow back via the parties now?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting one because the way it works now, you and I, of course, as journalists, don't actually give money to anybody. But if we wanted to, we'd be capped at $123,000 in total donations that we can give to candidates and party committees. What the Supreme Court ruled last week, I guess, is that those caps no longer stand. So now we can keep giving money. So in theory, I can walk into a room and write a check for $1 million. And then just that check gets divided up amongst as many candidates and party committees as will have it. Now, I'm still limited in how much money I can give to any one candidate or any one party committee for that election cycle. But now the caps on my total giving for the cycle are blown. I can give, I can salt my money around broadly.
And when it all comes down to it, do you think more money equals more votes?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, it's if you've got $1 billion and I get $1 billion, aren't we still battling over the same, you know, 150 voters? Because again, Mitt Romney was right. 47% of the electorate is pretty much baked in for the Republicans. 47% is also baked in for the Democrats. Those are pretty much, you know, locked in figures for a national race, and in a lot of the states, not far from that either. So there's just a few percentage points in the middle that we're both spending, you know, $500 million to fight over. It, are there more votes out there, or is it just we're applying more technology and techniques to squeeze out the last few?
We'll be watching that over the next few months. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great day.
You too. That's Paul Singer, politics editor at USA Today. He joins us each Wednesday at this time.